Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears. Hello, and welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about Bernard Goetz, the producers, and God knows what else. I am one of your hosts, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
So, Laura, how's it going down there in the path? Are you in the path of the hurricane?
Yesterday, we got a little bit of rain and some pretty strong winds from the hurricane, but today is bright and sunny and hot as hell.
So, what you're telling me is that you decided to send the hurricane up to me instead because it has been pouring for the past 3 days up here. And also, there is a tornado down in Annapolis, which is like 40 minutes south of here. And a lot of my friends still live there. I used to work there. I texted my friend to ask him if he still had a roof. He hasn't responded yet.
So. Oh, no.
I'm going to assume that until I hear one way or the other that he still has his roof.
I sent the hurricane your way because I felt that the crime in Baltimore had just gotten a little too much. And I thought that everyone needed to go inside for a little while. Everyone's on a timeout.
Okay. See, I actually have a response to that, which is that indictments for at least smaller crimes have gone super way down in the past couple years, that they are not filling judicial vacancies in district court because they don't need all the judges. Betcha didn't see that one coming.
So the lower crimes are going down. Well, No. They're not necessarily going down. They're just not being prosecuted.
I mean, either way, is it really a crime if you're not prosecuted? Like, who determines what is a
statistically, I guess not. Morally.
If they don't prosecute it, it's not a crime.
Just stop prosecuting.
See, that's how we figured out our crime problem, is to stop prosecuting people.
So that reminds me of something that a friend of the pod, Katie, and I discussed in college. Is something lost if you don't know it's lost?
Oh, it's like the tree falling in the woods thing. If you don't know about it, does the knowledge necessary for the state of the thing?
Right.
That's a really good question.
Yeah. So if I have a hat and I fully believe that my hat is in the closet, but in actuality, that hat is not in the closet. It's somewhere else. Is it lost?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I can tell you something that is lost.
What's that?
Me. Okay. Do you want to talk about this week's episode? Because we are trying to do another episode in this format, and I think it went pretty well last time. We haven't gotten any hate mail or any comments, so that's good.
Have we gotten any kind of mail or any kind of comments?
I don't think so, but that's just because I'm lazy and I haven't been disseminating this pod the way I should be, but I'm still working behind the scenes and eventually it'll get there once I figure myself out. But I actually was thinking of a friend of the pod, Katie, how she's more than a friend of the pod. She's more like the pod's godmother.
Yeah.
To which I say, can we just refer to her as our pod mother?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Yes, we can.
So,
Elizabeth, do you want to kick us off with season one, episode 13, Broadway Malady?
We open on New York City. And you can tell it's New York City because we see the Twin Towers, RSVP Twin Towers, and the Brooklyn Bridge.
Do you mean RIP?
Yeah, that's a joke. Another podcast. Oh. Where it's like RSVP instead of RIP because it's wrong. Oh, I'm like sorry, it. That's not funny. It's a little funny. So we cut to this old movie, and there's this lady singing. It's almost kind of like a Judy Garland type of lady. And the camera pans out, and we see this woman sitting. She has a legit projector in her living room, and she's watching this on TV. And she's singing along, or she's mouthing the lyrics. So you can figure out, basically, that this was her in a past life. And this lady's probably, what, in her 60s, maybe?
Late 60s, early 70s.
She's watching. She gets tears in her eyes. This young woman, who ends up being her daughter, walks in, makes some comment about the movie. And then we meet Barry, who is the brother of the younger woman and the son of the older woman. So he makes the announcement that he has gotten funding together for a Broadway play, and both mom and daughter are going to be on Broadway. And everybody gets really excited, and they all give each other hugs, and they're one big happy family. We cut to Cabot Cove, where Grady is on the phone to Jessica, and he is backstage at the Broadway play because Grady's new job, or assignment, or whatever, is as a bookkeeper for the play, and he has a new girlfriend whose name is Katie.
I think it's just Kate.
We don't hear a whole lot from her. I don't even really know why she's in here at all, to be honest. He explains, Jessica, you need to come to see this play while you're in New York with your boring lawyer meetings. And she says no, but it's Rita Bristol, who apparently big deal, and that's the older woman, and her daughter are in this play. And Rita Bristol is a big fan of Jess, and Grady manages to convince her to come down and see the play while she's in New York. In the meantime, we're watching the rehearsal for this play, and there's Rita Bristol, who suddenly, without any warning, has turned into like a super diva monster on stage, where she's yelling about how everybody else sucks, and she's like taking up all the oxygen in the room. There's this director, I nicknamed him Director Wig, because his hair, even if it is his hair, it looks like a wig.
I nicknamed him Director Dick, because he's a dick. Or Dick Wig, we can call him Dick Wig or Wig Dick.
Dick Wig. Dick Wig? Okay. Dick Wig is kind of pushing back against her, and in the meantime, Patty, the daughter, is on stage, and she's kind of splitting the lead role with her mom. And I can't tell, and this is something that I would like your opinion on, is I can't tell if she's actually any good. And I can't tell if people think she's good or if she's not great.
You're asking the wrong person if someone can sing well or not. I don't know what pitch means. I don't know what a tune is. To me, she sounded really good. I don't know why Dick Wig was being such a dick. I thought it was fine.
Well, there's fine, and then there's like Broadway caliber. So I wasn't sure if he was pissed off because he thought she wasn't any good and that she was just a beneficiary of nepotism. And he's kind of cheese because he doesn't seem to like Rita very much. And I guess he doesn't like Patty either, which is fine because I don't really like either of them, but they're just kind of there.
She's no Idina Menzel, or as Travolta says, Mandel Azeem. But Patty kind of reminds me of Molly Ringwald a little bit.
She does. And is it the hair? Because there is a lot.
It's the hair in the mouth.
Yeah, there's a lot of hairspray in this scenario, and like they do the whole like leg warmers and leotard situation, like, so that's super fun. It's like watching, I guess, an aerobics video but on Broadway. We meet Cy. I call him Pink Tie Cy, who is, ooh, we don't know his role yet, but he's kind of hanging out watching things. And then we have Statler and Waldorf, who are apparently the writers. And
that's their names.
No, Statler and Waldorf are those two grumpy Muppets who sit in the box and make fun of everything.
Okay. That's accurate.
Yeah. So Statler and Waldorf are the writers, and they're watching the rehearsals. Rita is being a super diva. She's crabbing at Barry for some reason. And then we see the next scene where Grady ambushes Jess at her hotel with his new girlfriend, Kate, who is Patty's understudy. I think she gets her, like, one of two lines in the whole episode where she just says, pleased to meet you or something. Grady peer pressures Jess into going to the dinner for this production. When they're at dinner in the next scene, the gang's all here. We have Pink Tie Cy, we have Jess, we have Diva and Daughter, Barry's there, Statler and Waldorf, and Dickwig is there too. Am I missing anybody? Grady is there, and Kate. I always forget about Grady.
What I found funny about this scene is that Grady begs Jess to come. You've got to meet Rita Bristol. She loves you. You're going to love her. But they end up sitting on opposite ends of the table.
And it wasn't like a small table either. Like, it was like a Last Supper type of table because there were like 30 people there.
Fucking Grady.
Do you think he was responsible for the seating arrangements? Because I can see him fucking it up like that.
I mean, at least he could have put Kate on the other side of himself, like, because he was sitting in between Kate and Jessica. So he could have at least switched that seating to where Jessica was two people closer to Rita Bristol.
Well, they have to yell across the table. They want to get to know each other. Pink Tie Cy, we find out, is an investment banker who is kind of putting his toe in the Broadway pool, and he's putting down the money for this thing. He hasn't heard of Jessica, but she doesn't seem to care. Barry makes this announcement. They're toasting Patty for some reason. Then they talk about starting Broadway previews in 2 weeks because everything's going so well. And director Dickwig is cheesed, and Cy doesn't look very happy. Outside of the restaurant, Cy offers to give Jessica a ride, wink, wink. And we're on this New York street, and there's a little bit of some nightlife there going on, the local wildlife, as it were. There's this guy who I've nicknamed Doomsday Kelly, who is this blind kind of doomsday prophet, yelling about how the end is near without being very specific, because if you're going to tell somebody the end is near, at least give them a time frame, right?
Well, but you know what? As the Trumpers have shown us time and time again, that really doesn't matter. I mean, how many times have they said, okay, by this date, Trump is going to be reinstated? Okay, by this date, Trump is going to be reinstated. And it just doesn't fit. No one is losing faith that Trump is going to be reinstated as president.
I don't know what that means for us as a country, and I guess these are the same people. Maybe they'll, like, all get COVID. I don't know. But the COVID is preventing us from hanging out IRL, so I blame them.
I was not sure if this guy, Kelly, if he was preaching the word of God or the word of Hemingway, because I heard For Whom the Bells Toll.
He has to prove that he's a well-read blind Doomsday prophet. So there's also this three-card Monty guy who is just kind of hanging out there with the folding table doing whatever it is that he does. Grady and Kate are going somewhere. Pink Tie Cy is taking Jess to the hotel. And then Barry is going to take his sister home. And his car is in the parking garage, which is like in a door, like right next to the restaurant that just says parking garage, and you can tell it leads to nowhere because the set wasn't that great.
Oh God, it was. I have a note that says the set is so cheap looking.
It looks like a high school play where they have to have like a town square, and they're like, well, here's the restaurant, here's the parking garage, here's somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I've seen better set design on Sesame Street.
Oh my God. All of a sudden, this random-ass guy bursts out with a gun screaming for money and jewels, but he doesn't wait for a response before he either shoots or looks like he's about to shoot. pretty much not broad daylight, but like literally people were like 5 feet away and he wasn't wearing a mask or anything. So he was just kind of this random guy pointing a gun at these people in almost broad daylight. It was very stupid. And he shoots Patty and we're left wondering, is she dead?
After the mugger shoots Patty, Barry immediately pulls a gun and shoots the mugger.
So mugger is dead. Barry had a gun and Patty is in critical condition. At the police station, Sergeant Nerd is pacing around his office and Barry is in the room kind of throwing his hands up, trying to figure out why he's been arrested. And it turns out that the weapon that he had was concealed. There didn't seem to be any dispute about the self-defense issue, as far as I can tell in this situation. It was just a matter of whether there's going to be like some kind of charge for a concealed weapon or an improperly licensed weapon. In the meantime, Lieutenant Nerd is eating carrot sticks and celery and complaining about how he has to eat carrot sticks. And I guess he's on a diet, but he's already looks pretty skinny to me, but I don't know.
This episode really had me craving carrot sticks and celery sticks.
At the end of the scene, it turns out that the DA isn't going to press charges for Barry, and Lieutenant Nerd has the line, one less bum to worry about. And I know we want to talk about this in the next portion of this podcast, but I just want to put the Bernard Goetz thing in your ear, just because this was around that same time and it kind of smelled of that a little bit. We have cut to Jess and Grady, who are in Jess's hotel room. They're watching TV and they show the big haired news lady interviewing Doomsday Kelly. And Doomsday Kelly explains that he heard the initial shot right after the demand for money. So there wasn't even a pause. Doomsday Kelly says that's what he heard because he's blind and supposedly he's like a superhero or something.
I've heard that when like people lose one sense, that the other senses become heightened. So
I heard that was true, but then I watched an episode of Criminal Minds where Dr. Reed said that wasn't true.
Well, I mean, I don't know which television to show to believe now.
Yeah, what are we going to do?
I've got conflicting television show.
Maybe you should do your research. Maybe you should watch some YouTube videos and eat some horse dewormer and then get back to me.
Okay.
Okay, please, nobody take any horse dewormer,
no,
please.
No, unless you're a horse and you have worms.
Yes, then you can take it. But I don't know how many horses we have in our audience, but if you do, I think you'll like our earlier episode, It's a Dog's Life, that has lots of horses in it. Doomsday Kelly snitches on Taki, who is the three-card Monty guy who ran away. It turns out the shooter's name was Manny Farkas. He was just some bum. Jess won't let it go. Grady says, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. But Jess wants to know more because she wants to know why Patty was shot before she could give up any of her jewels or money. Lieutenant Nerd, who is now wearing a suit, he also won't listen to Jess. And he's kind of being a smartass at her. Jess is still going to go investigate. She goes over to Rita's house. Patty is in a coma and Rita's really upset. And she kind of does that thing that I feel like maybe happens a lot on TV and happens when you're drunk, is you make a new friend and you literally tell them everything about yourself in like all your dirty secrets in like 5 minutes.
I'm sure there have been those moments, but thankfully or not thankfully, I'm not sure which. When I drink very heavily, I black out. So if that has happened, yeah.
So maybe you have told people and people are secretly laughing at you when you go places.
So I do remember a few times after or during heavily drinking and I've met new people. I remember this. I've said, oh my God, we're going to be best friends. We're going to be best friends. We're going to be best friends. And then I immediately like look them up on Facebook and I add them as a friend. And then like the next day I'm like, who the fuck are these people? As I'm scrolling on Facebook.
My friend Rafaela and I, two women about our age at a bar, and the next day we went over to one of their houses and we sang backup vocals for this CD that this woman was recording. And so my name is on the liner notes in like an actual album of somebody somewhere just because we got drunk and made new friends.
That's awesome. But I've always kind of been a little cautious of people that will make drunk friends and then like pursue that friendship. Like you're risky. That is some risky behavior.
I feel personally attacked right now just because almost most of my friends are drunk friends. But anyway, so speaking of drunk, we learn from Nancy Reagan here.
She is a cheap Nancy Reagan, sure.
She's been sober for 17 years and she has this whole poor Yorick moment where she's sitting with this bottle of booze and she's kind of talking about how it's been 17 years and what's going to stop her from drinking now that her favorite child is in the hospital because the bullet nicked her spine or something and she's in critical condition. It also comes out during this soliloquy that Barry kind of sucks. He hasn't been very good at business and he's had a bunch of movies and plays and stuff that have kind of tanked. Rita has no friends because she drove them all away with booze. And this turns into another after school special where she and Jess have a turn to camera about, but it's okay, don't drink, even though your life is garbage.
So a couple things. I didn't get the impression that Patty was the favorite child from this scene or any of the other scenes, really. To me, it seemed like Rita was excited because this was going to be both Patty and Barry's big break. Because yes, Barry has had really shitty luck in what he's tried to do in the past, but he was going to make something of himself with this one, and so was Patty. But the other thing, what kind of liquor do you think she was holding? It looked like a bottle of Chambord?
I have no idea what that is. That's too fancy.
It's like a black raspberry liqueur.
Oh, I just thought it was something like some old whiskey or scotch or something. That would have been my guess.
I wonder if she mixes her scotch with Diet Coke.
We should ask if she mixes, what is it, her gin with her, is it Coke? What was it, your cousin?
Gin and Coke.
Shout out to Laura's cousin.
Who recently graduated Vanderbilt Law School and took the bar exam.
Oh, good job. Good luck. Welcome to... Being a lawyer, it sucks. So
yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, why did you do that? You can go back and
RSVP.
Nice. After this touching moment, we're back to the streets. This New York street tough lady who apparently has a lot of people hanging out at her card table, and she and Jess have this really interesting exchange where Jess basically tries to bribe her into giving up Taki by ripping $100 bill in half, handing half of it to this lady and saying, you know, you'll get the other half whenever I get to talk to what's his name. It works because in the next scene, Taki's feeding her Mexican food that she clearly does not really want to eat, but she's doing that thing where she like eats to be polite. And she makes a comment about not having food like this in Cabot Cove, so I guess they don't have a Mexican restaurant up there yet, which is disappointing. Taki gives her the New York street tough routine. He says he knows the gunman was an amateur just based on kind of how he comported himself. He ran away because they're going to send him to Rikers Island no matter what. There was some kind of excuse that I guess he's just constantly being arrested. Jess is back at the police station where Lieutenant Nerd appears to be doing Kegels, which made me laugh.
Is that what he's doing?
Okay. I know, but the way that his face is and the way he's like moved, like I know they're stomach exercises, but like, come on. It's funny.
Funny when you think that he's doing Kegel exercises.
I mean, we gotta move that pelvic floor. Jess interrupts him. She's pumping him for information about Manny Farkas. Something's still amiss. He still doesn't want anything to do with it. He's too busy. There's too much crime in New York. But then we go back to the hospital where we find out that Patty is going to be okay, but it might be a little while before she's able to sing and dance again. This in turn leads us back to the theater where Barry is trying to shut down the production because Patty is unable to play her role, ignoring the fact that Patty has an understudy, poor Kate, who everybody seems to have forgotten about. At the last second, Dick Wigg brings in this famous LA actress named Lonnie Valerian, and she's working off of two-week-old information based on the script, and we're supposed to look askance at this.
I was wondering, like, there was a point to that where I called her Flashy New Actress, where Flashy New Actress, like, starts singing this song, but then that song had been cut, like, a week or so ago. That makes sense now that you've drawn the lines for me, because I was wondering what I was supposed to do for that information.
Grady in the next scene, even he's figured out that that was planned, so, like, nobody was fooling anybody. Kate's being a good sport, and then all of a sudden, Jess looks at the TV, and holy shit, it's Manny Farkas, the shooter. He's on TV.
Like, she was watching some kind of Law and Order type show. You know how Law and Order cycles through. There's so many extras that come and go.
You know about, like, that guys, right? Like, people who you see on, like, every TV show, but you don't know their names. So, it was funny because this episode of Murder, She Wrote has a that guy in it, which is the guy playing Barry, whose actual name is, I wrote it down because I didn't remember it, Greg Henry, who, in addition to being in 7 episodes of Murder, She Wrote, was also in Star Trek Insurrection.
So I was going to wait till later in the show, but I have a cousin in federal prison who looks just like Barry. I mean, I haven't seen him in like 25 years.
What did you go to prison for?
Arson and witness tampering. He's a South Georgia good old boy.
Is he related to the federal judge?
Yes. They're first cousins.
I believe one of my cousins is also in prison, but I don't know because I haven't seen him in 10 years. Yeah.
Oh my God. What if they were at the same prison?
I think so. I think he's in prison in Pennsylvania.
Oh, I think my cousin's somewhere, maybe in Louisiana now.
I mean, you got to try to get into federal prison.
So, okay. The reason he's in federal prison is because he allegedly burnt a motel down that was on the interstate.
I didn't know that was a federal crime.
It is because it was on an interstate. So there's like the interstate commerce. Ooh, kind of thing.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, and it was fraud, insurance fraud. Basically, the hotel owner, or maybe someone else, we'll say the hotel owner, hired my cousin and maybe my cousin's dad to burn down this hotel for insurance money, allegedly.
Holy shit. That's kind of amazing. Your family is more interesting than mine.
And then there was a whole thing about my cousin threatening his wife at the time to not talk to the FBI about it. So I think that may be the witness tampering. I'm not.
Sounds like an interesting story, even if you're not sure of the detail. Jessica takes this information to Lieutenant Nerd, who still doesn't care. Turns out the guy's real name is Morley Farmer. That's his government name. And Lieutenant Nerd tells her the case is closed, go away.
I thought that Morley Farmer was his stage name.
Anyway, we're going to call him Morley Farmer because that's what everybody else calls him. Jess tracks down Milton Berle. I got him confused with Berle Ives, and I'm so glad that I had checked myself before I came on this pod and talked about how much I love him as the snowman in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Turns out Giant Glasses agent, aka Mr. Milton Berle, doesn't know what happened to Morley, kind of fell off the map, kind of comes back every now and again, does some on-off Broadway stuff. Jessica asks him for Morley's IMDb credits because there was no IMDb in 1985. We go back to the theater where Lonnie is steamrolling Rita. Rita is pissed and Barry is way too eager again to shut this thing down. Barry and Dick Wigg start trash talking one another, and then they end up in a fist fight. And then Grady chases Barry off stage yelling something about money, because Grady, the financial genius that he is, has uncovered some shenanigans, Ray financing. He tells Jess about the shenanigans in the next scene when they're in a carriage in Central Park.
Okay, hold on, pause. Are we just gonna blow past the fact that they're riding in a horse and carriage? That just, okay, it just doesn't.
Are you trying to, like, appeal to our horse audience?
No, it just caught me by surprise that this is how they set the scene. It just doesn't flow.
It seems a little too touristy for either of them, and they're not dating or married, so why would they be going
yes,
on this
it was a
ride?
Little too romantical for an aunt and a nephew.
Maybe they thought, like, they were being, like, bugged or something, and they figured nobody would bug a horse and carriage or something. Yeah, that was really weird. Grady explains to Jess while they're on the romantic horsey ride that the plot of The Producers is happening with Pink Tie Cy because he sold 150% of the show. And if the show is a hit, he's going to have to pay all these backers their money that doesn't exist because he sold more interest in the show than there was. I don't know. It's the plot of The Producers. So just go watch that and you'll.
So I haven't seen The Producers, but I was kind of thinking about this a little today. And it seems like he's kind of trying to short sell stock. And one thing that maybe you can uncover some light on this, but didn't Grady say that, okay, so he had all these scratch papers, right? And it looks like there's like initials and then like money figure. I'm led to believe that this is kind of like a spreadsheet of who he has sold the play to and how much. But he says, in this, wouldn't surprise me for Grady, but he says, I've added these figures up and it adds up to well over $2 million. But each figure itself was over $2 million. Like there was a figure for $9 million and a figure for $17 million. So I don't know if Grady just doesn't know how to add or if he meant maybe $200 million instead of $2 million.
I can't think of an explanation for that other than Grady is wrong. We have a repeat of our second episode where Grady pulls up to a sketchy theater in his fancy red car that he got ostensibly from the woman whose rent-controlled apartment he's living in. And they find out that Morley was just kind of living in the theater, and they're talking to this weird theater lady who bitches about him selling out. There's some people doing, like, interpretive dance in the background, so it's supposed to be, like, this kind of beatnik place, I guess. And this weird lady says that Morley had an angel who was bankrolling his garbage projects, and Jessica wants to know who it is, but weird lady, I guess she's too stoned to remember, so she doesn't know. Jess ends up having her kind of aha moment. She sends Grady back to Giant Glasses to get the IMDb info because she thinks that Rita might be in danger. And holy shit, is she right. We go back to Rita's apartment where it looks like she's attempted to stick her head in the oven or has opened the oven to let the gas out. I don't know how long it would take keeping an oven open to, like, fill an apartment that size to the point where you could suffocate. I am going to ask my friend Marnie, who is a science teacher, and I will get back to you. Like, how long would it take to kill someone?
I've always wondered, like, I've heard people committing suicide by sticking their head in the oven, but does that mean that's how they die by carbon monoxide by doing that?
I think so. It's the same. It's the same thing like putting your
car,
hooking a tube up to your exhaust pipe. Rita has conveniently fallen almost dead near the oven, holding a bottle of pills, And apparently there's booze nearby or something to indicate, or the tox screen ends up being that she took a bunch of pills and booze and stuck her head in the oven. And that's what we're supposed to think. They're back in the ICU. And one thing I noticed, and you can tell me if I'm making this up or if I'm hallucinating, but there is a blonde nurse that comes out of the room, and I swear it's the same actress who played April, the police lady, in an earlier scene. The only reason why I think it was the same lady is because of the hair. They had the exact same hairdo.
Okay, I did notice the police lady that hands Sergeant Nerd some paperwork, because like she had like a nasty ratty ponytail like all the way down to her butt,
and she had that giant like poofy hair in the front and then the really long pony like ratty ponytail. And I swear to God, there was a nurse who had the exact same hairdo.
Okay, I've got to go back and watch that.
You gotta go back. If it's not her, then somebody was getting lazy with the hairstyling. They're all at the hospital. Pink Tie Sai is there. Dick Wig is there. Grady's there. Everybody's at the fucking hospital. Patty is here. Apparently she's all better because she looks just exactly the same as she looked before somebody shot her in the spine.
But she is in a wheelchair.
We are in the hospital cafeteria. Sitting at the table are Dick Wig, Pink Tie Sai, Barry, and Lonnie. And they're all talking about what this means for the play. And Barry's still like, well, pull the plug, blah, blah, blah. Grady comes in with this IMDb printout and just looks it over. It doesn't look like there's much going on because he hasn't done much, which he just kind of does like a pilot at a time. And I guess just sucks and goes on to the next one. And then there's an announcement over the PA system. They asked Barry to come to a certain place. In the next scene, it's Jess and Barry are in Rita's apartment, and apparently Rita is dead. Barry is not that sad. He doesn't seem to care. Anyway, he sucks. So Jess tells him that she doesn't believe the booze and pills angle, and Barry insists that she fell off the wagon, etc., etc. She figured out that the coffee was roofied because whenever she came in to Rita's apartment to find her passed out with the booze and the pills, the coffee pot had been scrubbed, whereas Rita had earlier talked about how she always had a pot of coffee going. And then he and Jess have this really weird exchange where she starts trying to, I think, imitate Rita, or kind of imitate like a mommy dearest, like overbearing mother figure.
Creepy. It was scary. It was brilliant. And it reminded me, so like in Psycho, when you would hear, because like during the movie Psycho, you only heard the mother like being crazy and overbearing. And that's what Jessica reminded me of, was the crazy overbearing mother in Psycho. Spoiler alert, the mother in Psycho had been dead, and it was really Norman Bates kind of pretending, or like not split personality, but yeah, pretending his mother was still alive. Super creepy.
Yeah, she started really leaning into it, and you could see it was really aggravating him to the point where he just blurts it out. He gets really angry. He like does this thing where he sits under this portrait of her as a young woman and starts confessing. He wants money. It's also because he hates Rita because she loves Patty more and she doesn't love me. So that's great. Rita walks in because apparently not only is she not dead, but she's also in the next room. She heard the whole thing, yet she gives him a hug, and I guess she kind of forgives him.
All's well that ends well.
Except for Barry, apparently, because he's probably going to prison forever. The show, apparently, has gone on with both Bristols having sufficiently recovered to be hits on Broadway. Everyone is fine. Sai is talking to the DA, and apparently Kate ran away with a weatherman, and Grady has a new girlfriend.
Named Francesca.
So that is the end of the show.
I think one of the biggest things we should talk about is the mugger shooting Patty and then Barry shooting the mugger in quote unquote self-defense. Let's start with that. So let's say that Barry had not hired the mugger, Marley Farmer, whatever his name is, Manny Farkas. I like Farkas better, to shoot Patty. Let's just say it is a run-of-the-mill mugging. Now, this mugger pulls out a gun and, you know, threatens Patty. Then Barry pulls out a gun and shoots him. That's pretty cut and dry self-defense. It is complicated a bit with the fact that Barry, he's illegally carrying a concealed weapon. And I think that in New York, it is damn near impossible to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon. In Georgia, they practically give them out when you get your driver's license.
I mean, that sounds like Pennsylvania, too. In Maryland, apparently you can get one if you're a judge or like a DA or something.
So there's this issue of whether Barry is going to be in any legal trouble because he killed a guy with an elite. Well, not the firearm wasn't illegal. It wasn't like a shot off shotgun. That makes it an illegal firearm. It wasn't stolen or didn't have serial numbers scraped off. So the firearm was legal. He was just carrying it illegally. I reached out to our pod mother, Kate, and I explained the situation, and her opinion was that it's pretty cut and dry self-defense. However, it would be prosecutorial discretion whether or not to charge Barry for carrying the concealed weapon. Under these circumstances, if it was exactly how it looked, it would probably be a real dick move of a prosecutor to charge someone for carrying a concealed weapon when they saved possibly two, possibly even more lives. Now, if you put it in a scenario where maybe a guy or a girl or non-binary person was bringing a concealed weapon to a drug exchange and shot someone in self-defense, that blurs the lines a little bit.
I'm going to shoehorn Bernard Goetz into this, the big case in the 80s about the subway shooter who shot the kids even though they hadn't pulled weapons. It was like perceived threat, and he was acting in self-defense. I think he was acquitted on everything except for like a minor gun charge. It wasn't like, what's the word, equal force or comparable force or that kind of thing, but there are certain scenarios in which your subjective perception of whether you're being threatened also comes into play. So it's not even always what's going on, but it's what you reasonably believe to be going on.
And what a reasonable person would believe under the circumstances.
The reasonable person standard is the universal joke among all lawyers, because anybody who's ever dealt with a client knows that none of the clients are reasonable.
I was just reading about the Goetz case, and what I found interesting, so there's the elements of the actus reus and mens reus, or mens reus and actus reus, and that's the guilty mind and the guilty act. So what happened with the Goetz case, it seems like that these four dudes approached,
they were black teenagers on the subway asking for teenagers. Money.
And one of them said, give me $5. At which point, Goetz gets up and just unloads his revolver into these four boys. Now, my thought is, give me $5 is not a threat. So my wife and I used to live in a really rough part of Atlanta, East Point. And we were getting gas one day, and this rough-looking gentleman approached her and said, give me a dollar. And she turned around and she looked at him and she said, you give me a dollar. And then he just walked away.
Your wife is a million times cooler than you based on that story alone. So sorry.
Oh, she's a fucking badass.
But also another interesting thing parallel between the Goetz case and this episode is that Goetz had supposedly purchased this weapon and carried it illegally because he had been mugged twice in the past. And Barry had told Sergeant Nerd that he had been mugged like, what, 8 times in 5 years or something? So that's why he
thought it was only three times.
It was a lot of times in a short period of time. So that was the same kind of thing. And I guess that was a large part of Getz's justification was, while I had been mugged so many times before, I just basically jumped the gun, so to speak.
But going back to the one of the boys telling Getz, give me $5, that right there, to me, in my opinion, has not crossed the line into criminal activity, which I don't think justifies shooting 4 people. I don't think that there was a sufficient act, maybe. And even one of the 4 boys later said, yes, our intent was to rob him. There was the mens rea. But to me, there just wasn't a sufficient act to satisfy that element of the guilty act.
I think that's where this case ended up getting so much attention, is because people kind of came down on both sides of a very sticky issue. And because that was like during a period where New York had even more crime than it does now. And the kind of prevailing attitude was kill them all and let God sort it out. I think the idea of a vigilante at that time was a little more palatable than it would be these days. But then again, we've seen countless times, like, white cops shooting black kids and fucking, what's that guy's name?
Which one?
The one who shot the kid in Florida, Trayvon Martin.
Zimmerman, George Zimmerman.
The guy who shot Trayvon Martin, who, like, you know, stalked him and shot him, like, and he got away with it. I don't even think that it would move the needle. I think that if that happened today, maybe not in New York. You couldn't get away with doing that in Baltimore, but I feel like you could do it in another city.
Anywhere in Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, outside of Atlanta. So, moving on.
Tell me about short selling stock, because the one thing that, for those of you who haven't seen The Producers, basically the plot of that was an accountant and a down on his luck producer set out to put on the worst play in history, thinking that if they get enough money put into it and the play fails, then they get to keep all the money, because nobody cares about a play that failed. So what they do is they put on this magnum opus called Springtime for Hitler, which actually ends up being a hit.
So I haven't seen The Producers. I know what it's about high level. Details into that kind of financial deal, I don't understand, nor do I really understand what's going on with the deal that Pink Tie Cy put together. I tried to look at a lot of different angles to see how making money or not making money would benefit or disadvantage him, and I can't figure out what the deal was. But Jessica said later in a scene that if the play does well, then Cy is in trouble. So that sounds to me like short selling stock. So short selling stock, in a very basic explanation, is you borrow a stock. Let's say I borrow Nike stock. Now I then sell that stock. So I borrow it. Let's say the market price for that stock is $10. So I borrow that stock. I sell it to someone else for $10. Now, I believe that the Nike stock is going to fall before I am called to purchase the stock. So let's say I'm right. So I've borrowed the stock. I've sold it for $10. Now, Nike says, okay, it's time to pay me. Let's say the stock has fallen to $6. So then I buy the stock for $6. I've sold it for $10. So I pocket that $4. Now, it's risky because that stock could also rise. So if I borrow the stock, I sell it for $10, and then Nike stock rises to $20 per share, well, then I have to pay $20 per share. Basically, don't ever short sell stock. So that was the whole Reddit GameStop issue, was that this investment, this hedge fund, had borrowed and sold, or they had, yeah, borrowed and sold more shares of stock than GameStop had actually issued. So some nerd somehow realized this and told everyone to buy GameStop stock, which drove the price up hundreds of percent more than what it was for when it was shorted. And then this investment, this hedge fund, lost millions of dollars.
That's kind of hilarious. I'm not a giant fan of Reddit on most days, but sometimes just like watching like the unified power of the masses, yes, do something like this, like, is always amusing for me.
Yes, I love it because it's the people, or like the small people, used the rules like against the people that usually benefit the rule.
Well, from then the rules. Like the hedge fund guys were like crying about it to the feds, being like, "Are you gonna let them get away with this?" And like, those are the same rules you play by. So,
and what was really super fucking shady was that there's this Robinhood app, which is like a platform for just ordinary people to buy and sell and trade stock. Well, this hedge fund that owned all this GameStop stock also owned Robinhood. So then Robinhood shut down trading.
Ugh.
Which to me screams of an SEC violation. It's a huge conflict of interest. But yeah, so that's my TED Talk. Thanks for coming.
After listening to Stock Talk with Laura.
Stock Talk with Laura. So, couple things. We are led to believe Barry laced his mom's coffee with a strong sedative to knock her out. And then we're led to believe that she tried to commit suicide by drinking a bunch of alcohol, taking a bunch of pills, and sticking her head in an oven. And the tox screens came back, right? The tox screens came back positive for alcohol and barbiturates.
Uh-huh.
So if she was passed out, how did he get that into her system?
Well, the barbiturates would already be in there from the coffee. I think that's what Jessica was saying. They put the barbiturates or like something like chemically similar in the coffee.
Jessica said a strong sedative. So even if it was a lot of the barbiturates, how much coffee would she have to drink?
I guess it would depend on like how big of a person she is. And she didn't look like she was that big. And I guess it would be how much crap was in that coffee. Whenever they said it came out for barbiturates, it wasn't barbiturates and then something else and alcohol. It was just barbiturates and alcohol. So I'm thinking that he probably crushed up some pills and put it in the coffee. That would be my guess. And because she's a small person, he probably didn't need that much to have her pass out, because that stuff was probably already like a sleeping drug or like a Xanax type thing.
Then how did he get the alcohol in her?
Have you seen that episode of Law and Order starring Kate Burton? I can't remember what it's called, but it's about the people who work at the wine company.
Yeah, wait. Yes. Is this an SVU episode? It's the Juicy... Yes. Is it the Juicy Grape? Is that the name of the wine company?
It's like Luscious Grape.
Luscious Grape, yes.
So in that scenario, spoiler, the perpetrator of the crime, his mother had been an opera singer who was on the sauce, but she didn't want to damage her vocal cords by drinking alcohol, because apparently that messes with your throat somehow. I don't know. She butt chugged it. So like, I guess in the Law and Order episode, they had sodomized her with a bottle of wine or something. But I think it's like a thing where you use like tampons or a situation like that. Or maybe they think he just opened up her mouth and poured it down her throat. But you can't swallow when you're passed out. I hope that's not happened, because that is pretty terrible.
It sounds like he butt chugged his mom.
Where would we be if we were watching this episode in 1985 and we did not know about butt chugging from that Law and Order SVU episode, what we would be here for hours talking about it. Hours. Jesus Christ. The one bone that I wanted to pick with this episode was that situation where Jessica found out that Cy was in financial trouble because her lawyers apparently like to gossip with his lawyer. In most states, we have to take this thing called the multi-state professional responsibility exam, which is, and we have to take an ethics course in law school. Lawyers have rules, as a lot of professions do. And the two big ones are don't steal money and keep privilege.
Yeah. And it's not just bad form. It's a violation of the rules of ethics. Yeah,
there's situations like if something's public knowledge or if there's been something that's been said in court or put on the record, that's different. But if you're sharing information that you wouldn't have reason to know other than the communications with your client, like, that's a big old, like, fuck you to privilege. And if I were Cy's lawyers, I'd be very upset. Or if I were Cy, I'd be very upset. His lawyers would probably end up being Rudy Giuliani.
So it seems that Cy's lawyers have already broken privilege by telling other lawyers. So then I wonder, can the DA that's prosecuting Cy, can he legally obtain the conversations and evidence from Cy's lawyers? Since
you mean like subsequent to it, like have like a conversation with them?
Yeah. So like now there's no privilege.
You could also argue that if there's a crime being committed and that they're assisting in it, then that they would be not covered by privilege because it is an ongoing crime. The one thing that gets drilled into us is privilege belongs to the client, not the attorney. So if I want to go tell you that my client Joe Smith is an alcoholic and he embezzled $1 million from his employer because he told me, I can tell you, but then I'm going to get in trouble. And then Joe Smith still has privilege. It's just that one thing that I blabbed is no longer privileged. It doesn't mean that his whole file is up for grabs, as far as I know. Whereas if Joe Smith wants to go telling everybody, oh, hey, I embezzled $1 million, suddenly it's not like privileged anymore. And then you can be like, okay, my client embezzled $1 million. There might be other rules that prevent you from telling the DA or disseminating the information, but like it's not privileged anymore.
No, that's a good one. I like that.
That was my main gripe.
I actually think I was like the only person ever to really enjoy my ethics class.
My professor was this old, old man who really liked talking about Richard Nixon and really enjoyed cursing. But he was this like old, like potato of a man wearing suspenders with a vaguely Southern accent talking about Nixon. Aside from being like a snobby do-gooder, why did you like ethics so much?
So I liked ethics because you had a rule book. It's not like con law where you had just like a bunch of like frilly little tests that may or may not apply. And you had all standard of these different standards and tiers and bullshit and bullshit. It's like, here is rule 1A. Here is rule 1B. Here is rule 1C. So I like working with statutes, which is also why I really liked sales and secured transactions.
Do you know what other area of the law is very code-based and has very little to do with precedent and all that messy court bullshit?
Bankruptcy, which I also practiced.
Well, yeah, also that, but also tax.
Yes, I knew that's what you were going for.
That was really hurtful. You just left me hanging there. That's not very kind.
Here's what I don't like again is that I don't feel that we as the audience were given enough information to figure out who the killer was. Although I gotta say, I knew from the beginning just by looking at Barry.
Yeah.
Because he reminded me of my cousin.
No, I knew it was Barry too. I knew it was him, but I didn't know why or how. That was the frustrating part.
I had a feeling it was Barry. So I did win. Yay. But so I'll give it 6.5 ashtrays.
Okay. That is super weird because I'm literally giving it 6.5 ashtrays too.
You're just copying what I'm not doing.
Copying. I was literally thinking it in my brain before you said it. But fine. Since you don't want me to be a copy cheat, I'm going to give it 6.75 ashtrays.
Ooh, okay.
So, yeah. So, just for the simple fact that they had the Statler and Waldorf homage in there, which I love my Muppets. And did you have a Golden Grady?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think anytime Grady's on the show that he... he gets the Golden Grady Award.
But for what specifically?
Okay, so for me, the specific reason is that that motherfucker cannot add. I'm sorry. How does all of those numbers on that scratch paper add up to $2 million when one figure was $17 million and one figure was $9 million? Even if you subtract them, it's not $2
million. Oh my God.
If you divide $18 million by $9 million, you almost get $2
million. I don't know. But no, that is a very good reason to give Grady the Golden Grady Award. Mine is because he's still driving around in the car that he got from the dead woman whose rent control apartment he still lives in.
It's a cute car, though.
I mean, it is. And props to them for continuity. But yeah. Still, you can tell, like, he didn't earn that car. Before we go, do you want to briefly...
Nope.
Okay. Well, then I will briefly talk about next episode. This episode is called Murder to a Jazz Beat, continuing with our performing arts theme. So, a talk show host and a cab driver help Jessica solve the murder of a New Orleans jazz musician. So, this should be fun. Looks like there's going to be some jazz and some mystery solving. We can look forward to that next week or whenever we decide to record again. Could be next week, could be like 2 years from now. I don't know.
Right.
We're trying to get on a more regular schedule, but Laura here had to take up golf.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well, before we go, we just want to tell you to rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you to Jeremy for our theme music and Rachel for our podcast art. And as always, to our pod mother, Katie. And thanks for joining us. And remember,
stay woke.
Stay woke.